Hello. This is Start With This, a podcast by me, Jeffrey Craner, co-creator of Welcome to Night Vale. Each episode, I and a writerly guest discuss a topic and then give you two assignments, something to consume and something to create. Start With This, minimal.
Art is hard. Starting is hard. If you want to start somewhere, you can start with this. You can start with this.
Playwright August Wilson famously wrote long plays, and his first drafts were even longer. He had a lot to say and a lot to pare down later. I love writing too much. I don't mean my love of writing is over the top. I mean that I like writing more than I need to write. Run-on sentences, excessive adjectives, lots of descriptions of characters' feelings, over-explaining the mechanics of the plot. It's thrilling to create people and worlds. It's less fun to whittle it all down into a coherent and smooth narrative. You know what's fun? Apartment shopping. You know what's not fun? Unpacking when you have to move. These days when I write, I try to make my initial drafts as focused as possible. It helps later in the editing process, but paring down isn't just about editing. It also helps your initial draft. When you start thinking less is more, you start feeling the flow of your story. You can keep your mind on the most important elements. And as a bonus, sometimes the best writing is the things that aren't written at all. I'm Jeffrey Craner, here with Bree Williams, writer for Welcome to Night Vale and Getting On with James Urbaniak, which that was one of my favorite podcasts of all time. Hi, Bree.
Hi, Jeffrey. I'm so excited to be here talking about minimalism with you. It's one of my favorite topics.
I am too. I will jump in and be all fanish, even though we've known each other for a few years now. But yeah, when Getting On with James Urbaniak started the same summer that Night Vale started, and I'm a big fan of James as an actor, and so I immediately started listening to that show. And it's such a fun and strange fiction world that he creates and that you and so many other writers have created on that show. You want to talk a little bit about working on that show and what you do as a writer?
Sure. It's interesting with that show, with the topic of minimalism, because when we started that show, it was very monologue based and we were ultra limited in, we were just doing straight monologues and that was it. And then at a certain point, James and I started talking about how might we expand this world to feel more cinematic while still being very limited in our resources? And like, what are the details we can add to sort of like expand that world for listeners? And I think it started with an episode we did called Lockdown, which is about a guy who is on, it's a sci-fi thing. It's about a guy on a spaceship and there's an active shooter situation. And by virtue of all of these other officers having been killed, James is the guy in command, though he's very unequipped to do it. So that's sort of the basic plot. But we were experimenting with just like a few sound effects to make this sound like, okay, now this is a whole environment rather than just an isolated monologue. It's still minimal in what we were using, but it was expansive, I think, in what we were trying to do and building out the world. And so I really love that episode for that reason, that it was just these very small things that we did and that James did in his production that really made it feel more full. And it was also a present tense dialogue between two characters rather than a monologue after the fact, past tense. So that was like an interesting thing too in terms of expansion.
I've loved that about writing podcasts because you are so limited. And we've talked to Joseph and I have talked on the show about limitations in your writing and in your creation. But yeah, you have to kind of leave it to the imagination of the listener. So in fact, a lot of times less is more in podcasting because there's no reason to fill their heads with much more than just the personality and the basic essence of your speaker.
Yeah, and, absolutely.
Does so much.
Yeah, it's because you're completely absent of the visual element. So there is a lot of listener engagement. I feel like when you have those limitations, you are asking the listener to be a more active participant. And I think that's really interesting and effective.
When I talked to you last week about doing this episode and thinking about writing minimally, I started by saying minimalism, but I feel like that's some type of ism-ish term that refers to a movement. And I'm not really wanting to talk about any movement toward minimalism or the six-word short story, the Ernest Hemingway bit. It's more about focus, writing less. It's something I've dealt with as a writer a lot, which is I tend to say something is a person is scared and nervous, and they also feel this, and they do that. And then over time, I start, when I go through the editing process, I'm like, 60% of this sentence is unnecessary. So it's trying to figure out how to write with minimal words and fill in later.
Yeah, I think, like, when we think about minimalism, we think a lot about style, like minimalistic style. So in writing, it's like short sentences, fewer adverbs, simple vocabulary. I think it's interesting to think about style as one element of a palette of tools that a writer or a creator has. I mean, I think that there's something to be said for thinking about the other elements in relation to minimalism, like minimalism of plot or of character or of dialogue or of time or space, and like all of these different things. So I think it becomes a matter of thinking about like what are the elements in your story that you want to emphasize and what are the things that you want to minimize. And sort of by virtue of subtraction, you are emphasizing those things that are left. And I think that that's a really interesting thing to think about when creating.
So I wrote down kind of like five subtopics of the idea of writing minimally, of what this meant to me, and we can stick to these or veer off course, however we want to do it. But I was thinking about details and descriptions, right? I tend to not write a lot of descriptions of what characters look like, unless sometimes there's a clothing detail that seems important later or something, or unless it's vitally important to their character. But the same thing with rooms and spaces. Like I try, and if I need somebody to know the door is on the left, I will let them know that. But for the most part, I try not to get into too many details about what's in the room. So the second thing was, you know, thinking about the Hemingway long, short sentences and short or long chapters, which I really love seeing short form things. I've always been drawn to poetry for that reason. Technical manuals, things like that. It just looks like I can really plow through this. The third thing was like how much you reveal to your audiences. Minimalism can be used so much for, as we said in podcasting, for surprise and mystery. The fourth thing is just white space. As a playwright, I just think of pauses. Love, love, love pauses.
Ooh, yes. And I come from a screenwriting background. That's like my formal training. So we talk about white space a lot. Like if you don't have white space dominating your pages, that is an excuse for a reader to throw that script in the trash.
Yeah, it makes total sense. And it's having just in the last couple years started teaching myself final draft writing in screenplays. It's shocking. I'm so used to writing prose, and even my playwriting is just formatted on Word. I never used a software for it. So my plays would probably in final draft be something like 40 pages, but in Word, they're like 18.
Yes.
And then finally, like practically speaking, I mentioned in the intro, like, you know, just getting to the point so you can save time later. Let's start with that point. I think that's the least important of all of these, but just thinking about editing and paring down. Are you a person who likes to like overwrite and then shave it down later? August Wilson always went from 5.5 hour plays to 3 hour plays. Or do you underwrite and fill in later? I personally prefer to overwrite and then add more later.
So for me, it totally depends on the form. I am like two different people depending on what form I am writing in. So if I am writing a screenplay, I am completely structural. In my initial draft, I severely underwrite a first draft of a screenplay. I am thinking about story beats primarily, and then I go back in and I fill in character details, scene details, dialogue. You know, I start thinking about those things more. But since story is so, and plot is so forefront in screenwriting, like that's what I'm focused on. But I recently, semi-recently, have started writing more prose and fiction, and I become a completely different person. Like, I overwrite everything. I am writing character descriptions, memories, flashbacks, backstories, like looking at every corner of the environment, and so much so that I like don't even know what the story is at a certain point. I have to go back and find like, okay, what is the actual story here? What are the important details? It's sort of like a guilty pleasure. Like I really enjoy the process and I love editing. I love deleting things. That's like my favorite part of writing. So that's a great joy to me. But yeah, I do both things.
I hate deleting. I really do. It makes me crazy. I think it's always because I'm sort of thinking some of it is I just like a passage. I like a joke or I like something, you know, the kill your babies bit. But a lot of it is I just start kind of looking at things holistically. Like I have a hard time just seeing one thing as its own individual element. So by taking a paragraph out or a section out, I start realizing how the root system is connected to everything else.
Yes.
And so I think, oh, if I uproot this plant, it's going to like destabilize the rest of the soil or something to that effect. That's not always true, but yeah, it's always a really, really tough thing. One thing I think of to myself is like how to know when to take my pen and paper away, like how to know when to just stop, stop writing. Do you have this thought too?
Yes, I do. And I'm sort of like of two. So there's two different things we mean, I guess, when we say that, right? Like there's like, when do you stop writing that day, that session? And when is a project done, right? I think it's really easy for me to know when I am done writing that day. I think I have like a burst of energy and then I notice that I am like rereading a bunch of stuff and I'm going slower and I'm like, okay, it's time to stop for now. In terms of when a project is done, I have to step away from it. I kind of go as far as I can take it and then I don't know where I'm going anymore. So I have to step away from it for a certain period of time and look at it again with fresher eyes. And then I can have a better idea of like, am I done to the best of my ability? And then I send it off to people for critique because I'm really a critique oriented like writer. I have a group of writers that we send things to each other. And so that's the next step in the process for me is getting notes. But yeah, I mean, it's like you take it as far as you can take it. And then that's when I feel like I can ship it off to other people.
I'd be really interested in talking to you later down the road about how to work in writers groups.
Oh boy. It's yeah. One of my favorite things.
It's a wild ride. And it's very rare that I know most writers have some type of writing group that they work with. And I have collaborators like Joseph and Janina Mathewson and people like that I trust wholeheartedly with commentary and editing and other people that I will sometimes pass my writing to. But that's a whole other topic. It's a really interesting thing to find that type of group.
Yeah, well, have me back when you talk about writing groups and collaborative writing.
Please. Oh, my goodness. So in terms of like long versus short sentences, paragraphs, chapters, things like that, this I think I really fixate on this more than a lot of people, and I know Joseph has too. I'm not sure if you think about this in your own writing, but do you have preferences of seeing short things, short form on page? I know in screenwriting it's super important, but if you pick up a novel and you see they have like 80-page chapters, and there's like 5 chapters in a book, are you a little bit queasy about picking that one up versus the one that has 12-page chapters?
100%. Yeah. I mean, I love seeing short, digestible bits. I mean, it makes me feel like I can trust the writer somehow. It makes me feel like, okay, they know the important things and these are going to be all the important things.
Right. I get in trouble a lot with editors when Joseph and I started doing books because I tend to not think about paragraphs as, you know, whole thoughts. I start thinking about paragraphs as just things that need to be how the page should look and be broken up. So a lot of times I just have the one sentence paragraph. Mm-hmm. But in my books, I have normal looking paragraphs. But I like getting to a point where there's just a single sentence as a paragraph. And I use that a lot. It feels really nice to see on a page.
Absolutely. I totally agree with that.
Going into details and descriptions, we should talk about this. Like, how much detail do you need to give about the visuals of a person, of a room, the sounds, the everything about that? How far do you need to veer off of plot and character development to give detail?
I think that's something I'm still thinking a lot about, because this is a prose writing specifically is something that allows for that, where screenwriting doesn't. And so that's still something I'm kind of navigating. But I think, and this is maybe kind of a vague answer, but I think it's more important to evoke something than to give specific details of it. I think that allowing the audience or the reader to fill in the gaps is like an important part of the process of sharing art.
Yeah, it's interesting about evoking a feeling, because I like playing with that a lot too. And sometimes I feel like just words as they're laid out, regardless of their content, sometimes just the sound of words or the rhythm of a language can evoke a feeling of some sort. It can make it feel sort of cool to listen to if you find a neat assonance or rhythm or something in a language, an unintentional internal rhyme or something in something that's not even poetry can sound really, really cool, and it can add to the feeling of a scene. But yeah, knowing how to stop doing that and remember that you do have to tell a story at some point in time.
Yeah, I mean, you do have to give some details, but I think the feeling is the most important thing, or it is to me. I think that's across mediums. It's like, what feeling are you trying to evoke, and how do you get there?
I was thinking a lot about working on a screenplay right now that it sort of reinforces the idea, and we know this in most forms of writing, but it feels especially important in screenwriting and in playwriting, which is say what you mean without ever actually saying it. So yeah. Instead of having a character say, I'm super scared and here are a bunch of details why, like it's a, you can have just the stage direction of seeing his hands shake as he picks up a letter off of a desk.
Yeah, I mean, it's that's sort of like the screenwriting 101, right? It's like the show don't tell thing.
Yeah.
An example that you hear a lot, like in film school, I mean, there's a lot of these examples, but one I really like is from Ordinary People, the film. There's a scene where Mary Tyler Moore's character is making French toast for her son, and he doesn't want the French toast, and she throws it in the garbage disposal. And it's this beautiful sort of like, obviously it's not about the French toast. It's about her trying to reconnect with her son. He is rejecting her, and she has these, you know, bottled up emotions that are coming out. And so that's what the scene is about, you know? So it's things like that, thinking about how, because I think behavior of a character is much more revealing than any description of a feeling or any line of dialogue that they can have.
And that's a much shorter idea, the French toast and the garbage disposal. It's a much shorter idea. It's a much shorter scene, and it's a much more visceral and compelling scene for
yes,
that than
absolutely.
Having two characters talk about their feelings.
Right.
Although in real life, like that's a really good thing to do. You should just talk about your feelings. Like, I think this is what we're fighting about right now, and can
yes,
walk through that
yes.
maturely, but that's a really boring story.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I love the like puzzle-like quality to these limitations. Like Janina and I are always playing with that within the wires of just trying to not say exactly what's going on and just to play in a feeling for a while, not the character's feelings, but just an aura of some general idea, and have somebody try to, you know, the listener just to willingly go along with that. Do you find this can be frustrating though? I sometimes do. I will read a book and I'm like, oh, you're spending a long time in this mood, and I would like to know more about how this couple is doing.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly can be frustrating. Totally depends on the execution. It can totally be the opposite. You know, it can be super engaging that the audience or the listener is now trying to sort of figure things out for themselves. They're, again, like filling in those gaps, using their imagination more, and trying to figure out the unspoken that you're laying out. So I think that it can go either way, you know, depending on how it's executed.
I always think about the Peter Straub quote, the horror writer. I don't have the actual quote, so I'm a paraphrase, but he basically just said, if you want to make the reader scared, just say that your character is scared. Like, no more, no less. If you say that, it will give you that feeling. I think there's a lot more to what he's saying than just that, but I like the simplicity sometimes of just sometimes it is best in a short sentence to say, this is exactly what's happening right now.
Yes.
This person is scared. We can provide a lot of other details, but here's that.
I think I half agree with that. I think, again, coming from a screenwriter background, this is like drilled into me, but it's like, don't say a character is scared, but show that a character is scared. Just find some behavioral thing that will signify that, I think, is more always going to be more powerful than saying this person feels this thing.
Right. Yeah. Because it's, yeah, the show don't tell is always the classic standby. Yeah, I completely agree with that. It's sort of jarring when somebody just says what it is that they want.
Yes.
You know, you have the Austin Powers, you know, $1 million or whatever. Like, this is the demand. It's the ransom for whatever this character wants. But the I want statement usually is sort of buried in a lot of other things. It's very rare that the character actually says, I want.
Yes, and very rare that human beings actually say, I want.
It's so rare. What do you want for dinner? I don't know. Choose. Let's talk about white space, which I think is the very concept, without knowing the phrase, but I think it's the very concept that got me into wanting to be a professional writer, is reading Harold Pinter in college and just really getting into, like, a lot of college theater boys of getting really into Harold Pinter and really getting into the idea of what is unsaid in a scene. And there's the Pinter pause, but the pause is about awkwardness, but it's also about all the things not being said. And it leaves it to the viewer, the audience member, to say, like, oh, I think I know what's happening. How do you feel, like, what do you use in terms of white space? Like, what do you think about when you think about white space in writing?
I think about white space really technically. I think about it in terms of readability. Yeah, just sort of a more technical, like there is access to this story. I can scan this page. I can absorb this story without doing too much work as a reader. So I think about white space in a really technical way.
Interesting. So, like, kind of how the words look on the page in a lot of ways is the important thing that you think about. Like, it's almost
yes.
like a visual art piece, white space.
Yes.
Can you kind of just glance at a screenplay? Can you just kind of flip through the pages of a screenplay and kind of just get a sense of the pace or even the quality of the screenplay?
Yes. 100%. I mean, I when I was starting out, I worked as a script reader at, like, a literary management company. And so there was this big pool of scripts that the readers would basically could say, like, well, I want to read this script and that script. And everyone would fight over the scripts that had a lot of white space. Those were the ones that, you know, we didn't have to know anything about the story, but that was, like, the first level to entry.
That's hilarious. And is that an ingrained piece of knowledge that you should look for things that are less verbose or less elaborate, that somebody who has an economy of words maybe actually is better at using those words?
I don't know if it says they're better at using them, but it at least says whether this is bad or good, I can read it easily, and at least there's that.
Right. So it's a practical thing of, like, this one looks harder to get through than this one.
Yeah. I mean, because chances are a lot of the stuff is going to be bad, but, like, wouldn't you rather read less words of bad? but yeah, I mean, I think it also shows, I think it does also show some sort of technical ability to be able to be economical. Like, when you see that somebody has that skill, I think it does tell you something about them as a writer, that they were able to choose what the important things were.
I think a lot about, there's a mid-century British author named B.S. Johnson. He only wrote a handful of books. But one of the books he wrote was called House Mother Normal. And the thing about B.S. Johnson was he really loved the idea of the novel as, if you were going to write a novel, you needed to hold to some pretty strict rules, and one of which is that the novel can't be fake. Like, it can't be fictional, right? I mean, it's kind of fictional in the sense that it is a narrative constructed artificially, but that there should be an honesty and a truth to it. And two, that he thought that we weren't, at the time, in you know, 1940s, 50s, that we weren't playing with the actual form enough, the visual form of the novel. And one of his few, like, truly fictional books was this House Mother Normal. And what it is it's 9 chapters, and it is, I believe it's 9, might be 10, but it's 9 chapters. Each one is a certain number of pages long, let's say 27. And each chapter is told from a different character's point of view in this elderly care home. And the very first chapter is the house mother of this home. And she is kind of talking to all of them as a group and, you know, having like a group night with all of them. And so she's talking, she's asking them questions, she's doing certain things. And then each chapter that follows is each other character's, it's what's going through their head as she's talking. So whatever's happening halfway down page 4 of the House Mother's chapter is happening halfway down page 4 of this other character's thing. And as the book goes on, different characters are of different levels of mental capability, because there's like a 95-year-old woman in there who has dementia, and many of her pages are just completely blank. And he uses the spacing on the page really, really well to kind of demonstrate people being checked out or being asleep or not being able to process what's happening, or people's minds wandering. And I just thought that was a beautiful use of space. And I picked it up only because I was flipping through being like, oh, look at all this white space. How inventive.
Wow. That's an incredible use of what little visual control you have in writing prose. Like, yeah, that's an incredible example. I feel like one of the only books I've seen that makes use of the physical space like that, but in the opposite way, is House of Leaves, where there's writing, you know, there's like writing on the page and there's writing in the margins and there's writing all around. And it's sort of like, that's like maximalism, right? So that is like right. opposite completely of this.
One of the things that makes House of Leaves so interesting, though, because you will get to certain pages where there is a very short chapter with not a lot on the page. And it's that give and take.
Yes.
Because you will get to like several pages in a row where like every last square centimeter is filled up with text, some of it written sideways or upside down or in a tiny font. And it can get a little exhausting. And then you turn the page and you're like, blankness.
Yes, which is sort of like the macro version of, if we're talking about short sentences and long sentences and like varying your sentences, varying paragraphs to sort of hit a flow, like to hit a natural rhythm versus just one thing, you know, just one repetitive thing.
Yeah. Rhythm is everything. Like, it's so hard. We'll talk about this in the create assignment later, but like a repetition of minimalism can be mm-hmm. really hard to maintain. Just as like a constant flow, a waterfall of words can be really difficult as well.
Yes.
But yeah, using white space as a beat, as a rare moment. I've been watching a ton of horror movies in this last year, and one of the common technical tropes that happens is there's a soundtrack, suddenly there's no music.
And then the jump scare.
Yeah, and that's the absence that you're like, ah, crap, here we go. The last thing I'll say, it's sort of related to white space, but it's just hiding information. I really love doing this, and I don't get to use it very often. I say hiding information. Some of it is maybe like building a mystery, right? Like, you don't want to let on who the informant is or who the killer is or whoever did what. But I just mean like limiting the audience's view or their listening ability to know what's happening. So, for instance, I think about actually a good example of this was, it was an old George Saunders short story that for the first several pages, I had no idea what was going on. And it seemed to be a story about two cave people or something. It's been years since I've read it, almost 20 years. But as you read it, you realize they're employees at an amusement park, and they're dressed in costumes, but the way that all the technical things that they're talking about, all the props and the things that they're wearing, doesn't make any sense. And then once you piece together what's happening, you're like, oh, I get it now. And part of the joy is just being thrown into a scene, but without being able to see who they are. And if you made that story into a short for television, it wouldn't work the same.
Yes, totally. I mean, it's all about like the form, right? Like, what are the limitations of the form? What can you use to pull back in the form that you're working in? Like, really thinking about that. Yeah, that's a really interesting example. There's this 2020 low-budget sci-fi film called Vast of Night that I highly recommend. I don't know if you've seen it.
Mm-mm.
But they do a lot with hiding things, and sometimes very physically. Like, there is a sequence where a caller calls into a radio show and he's telling a story about his involvement in like a top secret military program. And there are points in his story where the visuals actually fade completely to black, and we were just left alone with this very understated performance and his revealing of this story. And so they are subtracting completely the visual element. And this is very effective at emphasizing both his performance, the details of the story, and also making the audience just feel like they have lost their footing a little bit, and that like we're floating in space. And so yeah, that's something that really struck me about that. And there's other things like that in the film where they really play with subtracting.
Yeah.
and what is left. You know, by virtue, what is left is then very emphasized.
There was this, I think about like cat brain a lot. I don't know if you have cats, but there's something about, I think dogs will do this too, but sometimes the cat can be looking right at you and you could make a noise like kiss your lips together or, you know, clap your hands together. And the cat does not piece together visually what you're doing. And so they hear your noise, but it's echoed across some far wall and they turn their head like the noise came from 270 degrees the other way. And anyways, the other day I turned on a fan in the bedroom, like just like a little floor fan. And my wife was in the living room just outside the door of the bedroom. And she didn't realize I'd turned it on. Well, the door of the bedroom faces directly the far wall of the living room. And Jillian was like, what's that humming? And I said, well, I turned on the fan. She's like, no, it's coming from this wall over here. And as I was going to the wall, I was like, I'd hear no sound. And I was like, I think it's just the fan is bouncing off the wall. Anyways, it was like an hour later and the fan was still on. And I had come in from the kitchen into the living room and I had forgotten about the fan. And I just heard a buzzing coming from the far wall of the living room. And I was like, now I hear that thing, but we are connecting visual to audio. And if you don't have the visual information that a fan got turned on, you're going to hear the audio from wherever you first heard it. Anyways, we use this all the time in horror movies, for example, where you hear a scratching or a moaning. And you're like, is that a child crying or an animal? And that's really scary if you can't make that visual connection.
Yes, cat brain. I love it.
Cat brain. We'll talk about that in a future episode as well. Well, let's take a break and then we'll come back and give people some assignments.
Great.
Hello, Joseph here. I have two books coming out this year. Seriously, May 11th, 2021. The first 10 years, two sides of the same love story. So there is a love story that happened behind the scenes of Welcome to Night Vale between me and Meg Bashwinner, MC and tour manager for the live Night Vale show. In this memoir, we recount the first 10 years of our relationship year by year without consulting each other beforehand. It's a funny and romantic story about how differently we experience and remember our lives. Then on July 20th, 2021, The Halloween Moon, my first ever novel for ages 10 and up. Esther Gold loves Halloween, until the year that Halloween night just won't end. Even she doesn't want Halloween to last forever. No matter your age, if you are a fan of what I do, I think you're going to love this book. Get these books wherever you get your books.
We are back. I'm going to give you your consume assignment. As I mentioned at the top, it's one of my favorite podcasts of all time. It's a great fiction podcast called Getting On with James Urbaniak. This show has episodes from 2012 to 2016, voiced by actor James Urbaniak. There are several episodes written by today's guest, Bree Williams. There are over a dozen episodes for you to listen to, and they're all standalone. Each one is a first-person monologue by James, some exceptions. And they're funny, and they're weird. They're sometimes creepy. They're sometimes sci-fi. They're all over the map for what they're doing. But I think every episode is gold. But if you want to start with just one, I'll point you to episode 22, Status, which was written by Bree. Status is an internal monologue about reacting to social media. It almost takes the form of a list poem. And while there's some elaborate language happening in this episode, just want you to, as you listen, to pay attention to the moments where James goes into series of short sentences, like quick thoughts, like tiny Lego blocks stacking one on the other. But also pay attention to how he uses pauses. Sometimes those Lego blocks don't stack. They just lie on the carpet waiting to puncture the bottom of your foot. So that's Getting On with James Urbaniak, episode 22, Status. And get that wherever you get your podcasts. Bree, would you like to give out a create assignment for folks?
Yes. Your create assignment is to write a 200 to 400 word short story. It can be a monologue or it can be dialogue, but every sentence must be short. Make them 6 words or fewer. Feel how this brevity affects your pace. What moments stand out to you? What limitations do you feel when you're writing? Are you not able to use the descriptors you want? Adjectives, adverbs, compound sentences. Are you having to cheat syntax and grammar at all to make these sentences fit the restrictions? Does that actually create something interesting?
I'm really curious to try this one myself, actually, in writing this out, that it sounds really hard to do.
It does.
But I think it will be an interesting exercise for a jumping off point for later, because I think it will just give you a sense of something to feel. But I kind of wrote this create assignment almost for myself to create shorter sentences.
Yes, I'm excited to do it as well. I think it's a great exercise.
Awesome. Well, great. Well, that's all for this episode, but let me say one thing. Thank you, Bree Williams, for being on the show. I'm so excited to have you guest host with me.
Thank you, Jeffrey. It's been a pleasure.
Would you like to tell people what you're working on or where people can find you or your work online?
People can find me on Twitter at BreeZillionaire. I post any writing and project updates on there. So,
awesome. All right. Well, everyone else, your assignment is just beginning. Head on over to startwiththispodcast.com to join our Patreon, where you can share your assignments with other listeners, give great feedback, and hopefully find future collaborators. Plus, patrons join us for monthly live episodes where we answer your questions. Membership is just $5, which is a 10,000th of a Bitcoin, I think. We can't wait to see what you're working on. Start With This is a production of Night Vale Presents. It's produced by me, Jeffrey Craner, editing by Grant Stewart, mixing by Vincent Cascione, theme song by Joseph Fink. All other music is by Caged Animals. Find more at cagedanimals.net. And check out nightvalepresents.com for more information about this show and all of our other shows. Thanks for listening. Bree, I like to close out these episodes with a quote about writing. I think you know this famous quote by Ernest Hemingway, famous minimalist. He said, "There's nothing to writing. All you do is..."
Cat brain.
That's where I got the idea from. Thanks, Ernest. Hi, I'm Jeffrey Craner, and I wanted to tell you about one of my other podcasts, Random Number Generator Horror Podcast Number 9. So the thing is, my friend Cecil Baldwin, the voice of Night Vale, loves horror movies, and he's helping make the genre more approachable for me and hopefully for you too, one film at a time in a random order. Are you squeamish about horror movies? Look, I get it, and no worries. Just listen in and we'll tell you everything that happens. But do you love horror movies? Well, that's great too. Watch along with us each week. We've got nearly 200 episodes covering everything from The Shining to Leprechaun 4 in Space. I'm serious. We go in a random order. So check out Random Horror 9 wherever you get podcasts. From PRX.